Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
We contacted our new senator, Robert Kennedy, who became a New York senator in the late 1960s. And took him on a helicopter ride around New York to show him all of the point sources of pollution. And so we told him that our main program was how could we correct the gross national product, which allowed all these companies to not account for their air pollution and just sort of pass it on to the taxpayers and affecting the health of citizens in New York. And so I got so fascinated with what was wrong with economics.
What's wrong with economics is its theoretical irrelevance to what's actually happening in the world of people. Enter ethical markets, the idea that sustainable business economics must first consider human outcomes rather than just monetary interests. And it's the life work of our guest today on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Hello and welcome. I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute. Hazel Henderson is a globally renowned futurist, an evolutionary economist, and the founder of Ethical Markets Media. Hazel's made a significant impact on the investor landscape through creation of broader assessments of true market impacts across a variety of industries. Her discussion with Ellen illustrates how important it is to connect money power with public interest, and how industries that are now using a triple bottom line approach outperform legacy industries that damage our environment and lay waste to entire communities, cultures, and even countries. Later on, Matt Stannard joins us on the Public Banking Report to discuss the developments that Ellen wrote about this week on negative interest rates and basic incomes. But now, let's talk with Ellen about a couple of developments on the money horizon that raise some serious questions about the significant steps by the global banking cartels to separate us from our money, literally.
So your article this week is "Hold on to your wallets. Negative interest, the war on cash, and the $10 trillion bail-in." Well, we see more remarkable stuff happening with money, and now it's doing a disappearing act. What's this all about?
Well, there are four central banks, the European Central Bank, the Swedish Central Bank, the Swiss Central Bank, and the Danish Central Bank. So basically, the central banks of Europe are now imposing negative interest on the reserves that they hold for the commercial banks. And the discussion has gone to whether it's now timed to impose that cost on consumers. So basically what that means is that it used to be, you know, you would put your money in the bank and they would actually pay you some interest on it. And that would encourage you to keep your money in the bank. But now you'll be paying them to keep your money in the bank.
And, wow, so that means that you're better off having it in your mattress?
That would be the theory, but to prevent people from hiding it in their mattress, pulling it out of the bank, they are going to a system that's all digital, so you really have no choice but to keep your money in the bank. I mean, it only exists as a digital entry somewhere. Sweden has gone the farthest on that, so it's really hard to use cash in Sweden. Even ordinary street vendors are taking cards, or you can use your cell phone or whatever, but they're not taking cash. They have little signs saying, "We don't take cash." So that's pretty radical. I mean, the whole theory is, this is the alleged theory, the alleged reason they're doing it is that always the way the central bank has controlled the money supply is with the interest rates. So they would raise interest rates if they were trying to tighten money, and they would lower interest rates if they wanted to get people to borrow more and to get out there and spend their money. But it hasn't worked because they've dropped the interest rate all the way to zero, and still their economies are all stagnant, and so is ours. So we haven't actually gone to negative interest rates yet, but there is actually talk of that at the Fed. So anyway, the theory some people point to is the research of Silvio Gesell in, I think it was in Bavaria, for the amount of time that there was a Bavaria during the Great Depression, where they printed up extra money. It was called free money, and distributed it, and then they put a stamp tax, they put a tax on it. So you had to get a stamp every month that was 1% of the face amount of the bill in order to keep the currency active. So it was like a decaying currency. It lost value over time. And the people did indeed get out and they spent this money, and it stimulated the economy and it worked really well. So the question is, what stimulated the economy? And as Charles Eisenstein pointed out, you can't tell whether it was the negative interest or whether it was the fact that they put new money out there in the first place. So what these central bankers are planning to do today is to tax away the money without putting new money out there first. So that's not going to prompt people to get out and spend their money. I mean, if they weren't spending it because they didn't have enough, the fact that it's going to dwindle sitting in a bank account is not going to make them spend it more. What it will make them do is maybe shift it somewhere else if they can. I mean, they might buy gold or something like that as a way to save it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's, you know, almost guaranteed not to work. So you wonder what they're really up to. Surely they know that. Surely they're not so dense as to think this is going to work. But what it could be all about, if we go all digital, so that the bankers have total control over our money, which is actually a war on government, because it's the governments that print money, or, I mean, the cash is actually the money of the government, and it's always been the money of the people, whereas the digital money is the money created by banks. So if we go all digital, then the banks are totally in control, and so when there's a big bail-in, they can take our money, and they can be sure it's going to be there. And what is even more suspicious is the fact that last week, Elizabeth Warren and another legislator had asked for a study to see how much it was going to cost the taxpayers for the rollback that they did last December, where they slipped into the Cromnibus budget bill, where they snuck in this part where virtually all derivatives are now allowed on their books. It used to be certain ones were excluded, but now all those derivatives are going to be covered and the taxpayers will be liable. But it's not really the taxpayers. That's the thing. Under the Dodd-Frank Act, it was supposed to be about no more bailouts. So what the big banks were supposed to do was to bail in the creditors' money, and the largest class of creditor of any bank is its depositors. So that means they'll be taking depositors' money, but they want to make sure the deposit money is going to be there and that it can't flee at the first sign of trouble.
Boy, you're really staking out a rather frightening prospect where people really won't have access to their money unless it is in their mattress. If stores refuse to take cash and if they move us toward this cashless digital basis for everything, we really won't have assets unless they give them to us. Is that right?
Right. But what this tends to do is to prompt alternatives. I mean, we'll figure a way around it. So the good news is you can expect, if that really does happen, that people will quickly be looking for something else. And our proposed alternative, of course, would be publicly owned banks, where your money would be safe. There's not going to be a run on a public bank because it's backed by the state itself, and then they don't do gambling and derivatives and those really risky things. I mean, it's only the too big to fail banks that are really risky, and then the little banks just because they're hooked into that whole system.
Well, does that mean that people's money would be safer in a credit union or local credit union or a local community bank, do you think?
Well, it is in theory, but the problem is all those banks use the big banks for, like, they do overnight sweeps, and they use the big banks for correspondent banks to get liquidity, so that it could be frozen at all levels. That's the problem.
What do you mean by frozen at all levels?
Well, my recommendation is to go to your credit union and talk to the people and ask them what they do with their money. Do they do overnight sweeps? Do they use the correspondent banks? Because some do and some don't, I think. What I heard that was a safe thing to do is to put your money in a brokerage. You don't buy stock with it. Just put it there, because they actually are bailors. They actually are required to hold your money separately, segregate your money, unlike a bank. Banks are authorized to mingle their deposits and use their deposits for their investment.
Well, what you just described relative to having the money supply cut off by the banking institutions, replacing hard currency with digital credits, I saw personally in Cuba last week to see what a society looks like when it doesn't have credit. It was very interesting. Cuba is a remarkably successful country in a couple of social ways. That is that everybody can get a free education all the way through college. Everybody has health care. People own their own homes. And they get a monthly salary. But those salaries are a pittance. And there is nothing to buy. The most troubling thing for me was to see a really terrifically beautiful buildings that look like they're bombed out. The people own them, but there is no means for them to keep them up because there's no cash. They cannot get credit. Banks will lend, but at 100% of collateral. So you really can't get very, very far with that. And they are definitely taking a look at this. They want to change, but they created an alternative currency back in the early 90s, what they call their special period, where the economy was struggling from under the embargo, the failure of the Soviet system, and they really fell on hard times. So their Cuban peso, which is their internationally exchangeable currency, lost terrific value, and they couldn't buy much with it. So they stimulated the economy by creating an alternative currency, which they called the convertible unified currency, or CUC, C-U-C, CUC. And the CUCs actually trade inside the country alone. You get 87 cents for U.S. dollar for one CUC, but it's no good outside the country. So they have an alternative currency, but they want to eliminate it so that they can deal with the international banking and trade and finance world.
Wow, that is interesting. Another interesting thing is in Russia, where we, or whoever is responsible, they cut them off from our money system by penalizing them with sanctions, by cutting them off from the SWIFT system, the payment system. So what they're doing is they're coming up with a brand new system, which would be, I think, a much better model. They're doing their own SWIFT system. They wouldn't be doing, you know, gambling. They're talking about interest-free loans. They would make low-interest loans for businesses. It would actually be quantitative easing. They'd just be issuing the money directly, which is what they should be doing. And it would be like one big public system where everybody could have an account in it. And Ecuador has done that, where everyone can have an account with their central bank. And the central bank is, of course, the ultimate backstop. I mean, if your account is directly with the central bank, you don't have to worry about bailouts and bail-ins. And the backstop is the central bank, which has the ability to print money. So they don't have to borrow it from somewhere else and worry about whether that loan went bad. They can just create the money and keep everything flowing. So anyway, I think that's a really positive development, that what happens when you try to cut people off and try to get total control is that they will work around it and come up with something new. So I think that's what we're on the verge of, is new systems all over the place. But what was your sense about Cuba? What would you propose for them to get out of this problem?
Well, in talking with one of the economists from the University of Havana, he said, you know, there are a lot of ideas out there that we're looking at, but the biggest obstacle that we have right now is mindset. You know, people are stuck in a notion about how they think it should be. And that's a big thing to wrestle with, of course. But they have to do something, because the young people are given good educations all the way through college, so they are savvy, but they have nothing in the economy to invest their lives in. And what's happening is the young people really want to get out and try to build lives. So they're really up against it, and they have to answer some hard questions. It was interesting for me to learn that the Sparkassen, our friends who do public banking in Germany, have been to Cuba. I don't know just yet how they're getting involved, but it seems like there's a conversation that's emerging there, and Cuba is definitely making steps into some sort of a new future. They're excited about the new days with the U.S. Because of the relaxation of relationships. So there's a lot of new activity there, but you can see what a central bank could do rather quickly based on what you've said, Alan, about issuing money into the society for infrastructure and getting the job done by printing money until they build their economy strong enough, at which point the Cuban peso could maybe compete more effectively with the international market.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Mindset is the problem we're battling as well. Everybody thinks that free money is going to drive us to hyperinflation, but it won't. There is a lack of money out there, and that's the thing we have to demonstrate. And it's just been so beaten into us. That's how the banks have gotten control. But, you know, all the money we pay for taxes that goes for the federal debt just goes to the payment of interest. And we're paying like $500 billion a year on interest, and we never pay down the debt. Now, if we didn't have to pay that interest, that $500 billion would have gone to pay down the debt. We would have no debt today. That's the thing. You've got to issue the money first, build the thing. It's like they did in the Depression, like Roosevelt did, where you build the thing and then you pay back the debt with the proceeds of the thing you built. But you've got to get the money out there first. If the government doesn't put the money out there, where's it going to come from? Because all of our money is debt. There's no real money in the system.
Well, thank you, Ellen. We'll see what happens next.
It is my great pleasure to be speaking with Hazel Henderson, a world-renowned futurist, evolutionary economist, worldwide syndicated columnist, consultant on sustainable development, author of 9 books, and founder of Ethical Markets Media. We're also most honored to have her on the advisory board of the Public Banking Institute, and she'll be speaking at an upcoming conference on public banking in New Hampshire on December 5th and 6th. So, welcome, Hazel. It's so great to be speaking with you.
Thank you very much, Ellen. This is a pleasure.
Likewise. So most people that listen to this show probably know you already, but you have such an interesting personal history. I wondered if you might share some of it with us. You've made huge strides in your life, but you didn't come up through the ordinary academic channels. You came at it from the outside and saw that conventional economics was all wrong, that we put our faith in the wrong religion. So
yes.
I can relate to that because I came from the same place. And you're a great inspiration to me. So I wondered if you could just, you know, go into your history.
Yes, well, I'd be happy to. I grew up in a small town in Britain. And I graduated from high school and then jumped into, you know, the great university of life as a packer in a ladies' dress shop. And and then I graduated to being a salesperson, selling ladies' dresses. Mm-hmm. And so I had a good education because I learned a lot of history and literature and good reading and writing skills. And they stand you in good stead for your whole life, you know. And I was a passionate reader, but I didn't really engage with my kind of life's work until I came to New York, became a naturalized American citizen, and settled down and started a group in New York City in 1964 called Citizens for Clean Air. Basically because I was really worried about my little kid at that point, you know, very, very tiny child, and playing in the play park there at Tudor City, right opposite the UN, right under the smokestacks of Consolidated Edison. It used to blow out the smokestacks at night, and we would take our beautiful, clean little babies to play in the sandbox, and they would come back, you know, all covered with soot. So basically, I kind of got together with the mothers in the play park, and we found a very sympathetic member of the New York City Council. And he gave us a little hole in the wall in his office, and we started Citizens for Clean Air. And so I began researching the whole air pollution problem in New York and realized that there was something terribly wrong with economics because, you know, I would go to these companies, you know, and they would, the public relations person would take me to lunch and explain, you know, that there was no way they could do anything about the pollution they were creating, because that was just kind of not on their balance sheet, that they were allowed to externalize those costs from the balance sheet. And I was rubbing my head in amazement, you know. And so I just began to, I went on a huge reading jag, and we were organizing. We ended up with block captains in all the boroughs, and we had 40,000 members. And we contacted our new senator, Robert Kennedy, who became a New York senator in the late 1960s. And we sought his help, and we took him on a helicopter ride around New York to show him all of the point sources of pollution. You could just see where it was all coming from. And so we told him that Citizens for Clean Air, that our main program was how could we correct the gross national product, which allowed all these companies, you know, to not account for their air pollution and just sort of pass it on to the taxpayers and affecting the health of citizens in New York. And he went on the helicopter ride, and I still have one of my pride possessions, and that is a letter from Senator Kennedy thanking me for arranging the helicopter ride. That was in 1967, and then he went on to the University of Kansas and gave that very famous speech about everything that was wrong with GNP.
Wow, that's great.
And so I got so fascinated with what was wrong with economics. And you know, Ellen, that it's very easy to approach a discipline if you're approaching it from the point of view of, I want to figure out what's wrong with it.
Uh-huh.
That's much easier than being sort of sucked into it and having to go through Economics 1, you know, where you end up with being cognitively captured. And,
right.
Yeah. And so you end up with what Daniel Kahneman calls theory-induced blindness.
Uh-huh.
So actually, the fact that I never went to college was a huge advantage. You know, I didn't waste 4 years, didn't end up with all the wrong information, and didn't end up with any student loans.
Right. In law school, my husband was, he was on the law review, and he was too busy to read the books. And he said, don't read the books, they'll just confuse you. He said, listen, you know, just read the outline. And he did really well in the third year. He was off the law review, and I was on the law review. He was ahead of me. He's actually younger. So that year, I didn't have time to read the books, but he did. We had one course together, and it was the worst grade he had gotten in all law school, and I did quite well in that class. So anyway, you get so submerged in these details that you can't really see the big picture, whereas if you can do your own research, you know exactly what you're looking for, and you can just focus on that one thing.
Yes.
And, you know, filter out all the other stuff. You don't need to learn that because no teacher is going to be asking you about it. Yeah.
Yes. Well, for me, it was okay. What I learned was look for the assumptions. You know, forget about all the bird scratching, you know, and all of the algebraic symbols and everything like that. And just figure out what are they assuming and what makes them think that. And then if you have those two kind of conceptual tools, it's pretty easy to realize that it's all a bunch of opinions, you know, an ideology parading a science covered up with fancy mathematics.
Right. So you have this great image of economics as a layer cake, and they're not reporting like a couple of the layers. Do you describe that?
And that diagram, you know, the history of that diagram, which I drew in 1981 after I was writing my second book, The Politics of the Solar Age, and my daughter, who was about 12 at the time, came into my office at home, and she said, Mom, what do you do? And so I drew that diagram. and then explained to her that what I was trying to do was to rethink, you know, what economics was all about and see if I could put it down all into one diagram. And, you know, the parts that were being left out being the two lower layers of the cake. You know, the top layer, of course, is the private sector, and everybody loves to be in the private sector. I certainly do. And then that rests on the public sector, and you have to have a public sector, you know, investing in schools and roads and airports and what have you. And then there were these two lower layers of the cake that the economists totally ignored. The third one being what I called the love economy. And that was all the unpaid work. And I did a lot of research into that and found pretty well that in almost every society, even industrial societies, about 50% of all the productive work is unpaid. Mm-hmm. And then that made me think, well, isn't that interesting? You know, how does a society decide which jobs are going to be highly paid and which jobs are going to supposedly have to be done free? And so, you know, and then, of course, the bottom layer of the cake was nature's productivity, which was also totally ignored. Mm-hmm. And so I began to realize, my gosh, they have a map of only half the territory. No wonder, you know, the air is polluted and people are getting sick and we've got unemployment. And how can you manage a complex society with a map of only half the territory?
Well, that just shows that if you aim for the 12-year-old understanding, I mean, those are the famous images, the things that last, that really make an impression. My mother's 96, and she still doesn't know what I do. She likes my brother best because he plays the violin. It's something she understands.
No, it is wonderful. I mean, you know, I taught at a business school in São Paulo for many years, mostly in the 1990s. And the president of that business school, you know, which is the most famous and the most professional and popular in Brazil, it's called Amanake Institute. And he used to sit me down at the end of these sessions with, you know, they've put maybe 30,000 or so corporate executives through those training courses, as well as mayors and governors of the country and all that. And so he would say to me, now, Hazel, you know, you are going to do this video cast that we're doing right now, and you're going to do it for 12-year-olds, mm-hmm. you know, or high school students. And that's what I would aim for. And he always told me afterwards, you know, that is the way to communicate the clearest, you know.
Yeah, it's hard to do, though. I mean, it's hard to even think on that level. When you know so much, it's hard to filter out your message to where you're right down to the basics and you can...
Yes, you know. Although it was very easy for me because I realized very quickly that economics was about obfuscation. Uh-huh. And that all of the trivial details were there precisely to get you distracted from, you know, the main thing. Mm-hmm. And if you look through economic textbooks, you will find that all of their examples are extraordinarily trivial. And I realized that, oh, I see, that's actually, you know, an intellectual method. It's a sort of didactic method. Mm-hmm. And so then you test people on their ability to regurgitate all of those trivial examples. And it's very easy, you know, completely fill up all people's circuits with that stuff so that it's very hard for them to go back and pull back and take a wide shot. Mm-hmm. You know, what's this really about?
Yeah, and when we have things like terrorist attacks or whatever, I'm highly suspicious, but then you always wonder, well, I wonder what else is going on in the world that they're not reporting, that they're managing to fill up the news with this instead of that. Well, for example, the climate summit that's coming up, November 30th, December 11th, that's kind of gotten obscured by all these terrorist attacks and so forth. You just wrote an article called Risks, What Risks? That was about how Wall Street investors, environmentalists, see risk differently, and we need to come together on that. And that was kind of about the climate summit, where even on climate, people can't even agree on whether what the issue is, and therefore, you know, you can't agree on the solution until you agree on
how did the problem arise, you know, and who caused it, and who's responsible. And we're still at that stage. I mean, we at Ethical Markets are going to be co-sponsoring an event there with our buddies at Helio International. And this is a solar energy scientific group that I've been on the advisory board of for about 25 years, and they've produced a very interesting index which fits perfectly with our Green Transition Scoreboard, and it's looking at which countries in the developing world, particularly in African countries, are most conducive to be able to introduce solar and wind energy and energy efficiency, going beyond the old industrial idea that everybody has to have big central power plants and great long grids. What we find now, as Ted Koppel is pointing out to us in his new book, Lights Out, you know, that these national grids, you know, are extremely vulnerable, and it's far better to have short loops, you know, and of course, all of those African countries are perfect for local and regional development of solar and wind power, and just more efficient technologies. You don't need all these. These people are never going to be able to afford nuclear power plants or, you know, huge national grids. And so, why not go for the most efficient technology in the first place? So we decided to join forces with Helio. And we're going to be, you know, putting out both of these indexes. Their index is as I say, really about more the micro, which is exactly what's needed now, because there's all of these wonderful solar energy companies that need help in getting into, you know, developing countries and knowing the ropes and how to get started.
Speaking of Green Transition Scoreboard and Ethical Markets, could you describe what those are and what your focus is?
Yes. Well, I started Ethical Markets Media 10 years ago because I felt that the mainstream media, which most of their advertising comes from the fossil fuel sectors, or nuclear power, and I knew they would never be able to cover the emergence of what I call the next economy, which is the solar age-driven economy. And so that was really why I started Ethical Markets. And then when we saw the UN conference coming up in 2009, the conference in Copenhagen, by that time, you know, I just knew it was going to be a train wreck, mostly because the way, and this comes back to economics, the economists had hijacked the Kyoto process back in Kyoto in 1998 when they developed first approach to reducing carbon emissions. The economic profession, and I actually found a letter by the president of the British Association for Professional Economists to send out to their members just before this Kyoto conference in 1998. And he said, "We must capture the climate change issue for our profession." And the way they did that, of course, within the Kyoto Protocol, was to try to make it all about trading mechanisms, trading carbon, and cap and trade systems. And as you know, they've been pretty much a total failure. They haven't taken one molecule out of CO2 out of the atmosphere since then, but they've made a lot of financial people wealthy, and all of the trading back and forth of these various allowances and offsets and all of this stuff. And so by the time they got to the Copenhagen meeting in 2009, it was just obvious that the way it had been set up, it was all about naming, blaming, and shaming. You know, there was the Tier 1 countries, which were the developed countries who used up all of their, you know, they'd grown their economies by emitting all of this carbon. And then there was the developing countries, mostly in the South, and they were saying, well, hey, you know, you guys did all the polluting, and so you clean it up. You know, don't ask us to. And what I realized was that, oh, my Lord, that there's going to be all of this arguing, and they're going to leave on the table the thing they all agree about. And that is that, you know, economies are going to have to move toward renewable resources and low-carbon forms of clean energy. Mm-hmm. And so we put together the first Green Transition Scoreboard just to sort of needle the bureaucrats that were there and say, look, the private sector investors like me have already put, our first number was $1.2 trillion was already in the pipeline from green private investors, no government money at all. And so that was how we started. And so we update it twice a year and have done ever since. And our new number is $6.22 trillion in the pipeline. And it's been a very good way to get into the whole development of the solar age economies. You know, if you can tell even the climate deniers in the U.S. Congress, of which there are about 75, if you can tell them, look, if $6.22 trillion is already in the pipeline with private green investors, and we have a very strict definition of what we mean by green investors, then, you know, you guys are just on the wrong side of history. And you're taking all this money from the fossil fuel industry right now, but there's a wall of money coming at you from the other direction. And so I don't even kind of bother to use the facts or try to have, you know, rational debates with any of these people. You know, you just keep on investing in the good stuff and keep on reducing the price of solar panels and scaling these technologies, which is what's happening now. So they're pretty much unstoppable because they're now cheaper than coal and cheaper than nuclear.
Wow, that's great. Yeah. It's all about money. And then ethical markets. So what is an ethical market?
Well, what I'm saying in our rather lengthy state of purpose is that you can't do markets without ethics and trust. It's all about trust. As you know from banking and money, Ellen, that that money is all about trust. You know, as I think as Volcker said one time, that it's all a confidence game.
You know, right.
If you don't believe in the money, you know, it's worthless. And, and of course, we're in that kind of a crisis today, as you know. And so our whole point was, you know, okay, markets were a fabulous invention, and they go back to the dawn of human history, of course. And they don't work without trust and relationships, however you want to define that. And so that's kind of the bedrock. And we got from there, of course, because of that I spent 22 years advising the Calvert Group, you know, on developing their social screens for their portfolios, you know, to screen out companies that had bad records in pollution, you know, manufactured weapons or unfair to workers and all of those criteria we developed, which now, of course, covers one in every $6 invested on Wall Street. So that's grown hugely now into a whole new industry, this ethical auditing of corporate performance.
And so you're telling investors what they can invest in that would be ethical for...
Yes, that's the whole idea, you know. And so that's grown enormously and completely changed the marketplace.
And they're equally good investments as non-ethical.
Oh, yes. In fact, actually, and there's a lot of studies now to show that they outperform the market because it's really... it's another way of judging management performance. It says that management has a longer view of what's going on and a broader model
you know, so that they're not flying blind into situations that end up where they've got a lot of costs overhanging their balance sheet, you know, to clean up pollution. I mean, look at BP, and I look at just what happened to Volkswagen. The more management has its eyes open and looks at the broader picture, and ethical concerns, actually, you know, the safer the investment is. And so we publish a lot of those kind of studies. And so we found ourselves very quickly in what you might call the standard-setting business. And this is a venerable business in industrial societies that started a long time ago, the idea of setting standards. For example, with the early railroads, where all of the gauges were different. And so you couldn't transfer from one track to another. You know, we're all familiar, like with Underwriters Laboratory, where, you know, all of the standards of the toasters you buy and it's not going to catch fire. And so basically, we have been putting out our own kind of standards, not only critiquing the standards which people use for ethical investing, green investing, and what we call ESG investing. That means environmental, social, and governance performance. And all of this kind of thing. And so then we started going from critiquing and reporting on other people's standards to developing more of our own, like the Green Transition Scoreboard. And then I funded and launched one in advertising, because advertising is a huge problem and all the misinformation there is. So we set up, and we're now in our 10th year for this, the Ethic Mark Awards for advertising that uplifts the human spirit and society. And, of course, at the beginning, everybody said, oh, God, you know, that's really mushy kind of stuff, you know. And now we find we're getting real traction. And the two campaigns that won our 10th annual awards were just announced at the Socially Responsible Investing Conference, which takes place in Colorado every year. Our two winning campaigns this year, one was from Cambodia and the other was from Pakistan. So we find that very few North American ads cut it. But we've been giving awards for Brazilian ads, for European ads, for ads from India, all over the place, you know, where there really is an ethical and educational component. And I always figured, you know, that our major educational system on this planet is advertising. It's a $500 billion a year industry, and most of it is miseducation. So that was one of the reasons that we set up that standard, because we knew that you couldn't try to punish ads that were greenwashing or misinforming people, because they would immediately hide behind the First Amendment and say, oh, you're against free speech. So we thought, okay, you know, let's make it a carrot. And we're moving the needle a little bit, but we're moving the needle on that.
It's really cool.
And then, of course, there's the Green Transition Scoreboard. And then we got even more ambitious, and we got together with my friend Janine Benyus at the Biomimicry Institute, and we had a mind melt down here for a whole week and came up with the principles of ethical biomimicry finance to retrain asset managers about the way the planet actually works. Because all that stuff they learn at the Harvard Business School is mostly wrong. And, of course, the very newest one that we've just put out is challenging the global gem mining industry. So we're taking on De Beers and the diamond cartel.
You know, that could be a bit dangerous.
Yeah.
So you're doing it in what way? What's the alternative?
Well, the alternative is that diamonds now and gems, other gemstones, are created by human science and that are absolutely chemically indistinguishable from those that are mined out of the earth. So this whole segment of the mining industry is now unnecessary and obsolete.
And so the best thing to just change the whole marketplace is to set up a standard. So we've set up a standard called EthicMark Gems, and they certify only gems which are humanly created in scientific laboratories. And what we found to our amazement is that there's lots of companies now in many countries that are making gems and beautiful jewelry using these humanly created identical stones to those mined out of the ground. So why on earth would anyone want to buy one mined out of the ground, you know, with all the horrors and the human misery and the conflict and the pollution? Why would anybody buy that if they could have exactly the same thing made in a laboratory? And, of course, I have to say, a fraction of the cost.
And they're made by actually duplicating what nature does?
Oh, yes. They are now so chemically identical that even jewelry experts under a microscope can't tell the difference. The only difference that there might be is that you won't find any flaws in the ones produced in the labs, whereas, of course, the natural ones, every now and then, will have a flaw in them.
Wow.
It's the only difference.
It's interesting.
And they make diamonds and rubies and sapphires and emeralds. And so all we are doing, we're not trying to get into selling the gems. All we are saying with our standard is that this EthicMark gem standard guarantees that the gem you are buying was not mined from the earth, and therefore is conflict-free, cruelty-free, and doesn't create pollution. And we don't even get into the price, but of course when they look at the difference in the price, then there's totally no contest. I mean, you know, I think this is going to be particularly good for millennials, you know, because they love to have these kind of values, you know, they care about the planet. And also many of them have that student debt.
Right.
And so if they can get a perfectly beautiful engagement ring, you know, for or whatever, for 1/1000th of the price of a diamond, and it is actually a diamond. The only difference is that it was created in the lab rather than dug out of the earth.
Wow, that's great. You had written about Japan. They're criticized as, or they're said to be, and everybody focuses on the debt, but what they're not looking at is the sustainability side of the
balance. Yes,
they're not
exactly
looking at the assets.
Well, that's so back to the whole GDP thing, you know.
Yeah, so how would you rewrite GDP so that we could reflect the asset side, the things that you build with this money that put you in debt that actually are better for the economy? I mean, they're more sustainable, they improve the quality of life. So basically,
I developed these quality of life indicators with Calvert. And now they were called the Calvert Henderson Quality of Life Indicators. And we decided that there should be at least 12 aspects of measuring the progress of a country and its real quality of life and real prosperity. And of those 12, only about 4 of them had anything to do with money. And the others, like, just to take an example, urban air pollution, which was our main indicator on the environment, because that's what affects most people, you wouldn't measure that in money terms. You'd measure it chemically by how many parts per million of junk are in the air. And we have a human rights indicator. You wouldn't measure that by money, and so on and so forth, you know. So about 2 years ago, Calvert was kind enough to turn those indicators back to me, since I'd sort of done most of the work on them. And so we've rebranded them now as the Ethical Markets Quality of Life Indicators. And it's a systemic, multidisciplinary view. And where it's appropriate to use a money measure, we do. And where you have to use other scientific approaches to measuring it, you know, like healthcare, It's much better to use disability-adjusted years of life, longevity, that you wouldn't choose. I mean, what's wrong with a lot of the healthcare system that we have now is there's too much money in it. You know, it's the most expensive healthcare system in the world, twice as much as others like in Canada and Britain and Europe that get better outcomes than we do. So we wanted to get away from inappropriate money measures and say, well, look, we're not talking about the inputs, we're talking about the output. The same with our education. It isn't a matter of how much money you throw in the front end. It's what comes out the other end. So there, all of these 12 aspects of quality of life are measured in the outcome, which is really what you're trying to do. So we are right now with our rebranding of that. We are updating them, and we're going to relaunch them again pretty soon.
Oh, that's great. Well, we've come to the end of our time, I guess, but do you have websites you'd like to point people to? Or?
Well, our main website is ethicalmarkets.com, and our TV shows, of which you have starred in one, Ellen, are in global distribution to colleges and business schools and libraries at films.com. And then we have the Green Transition Scoreboard, which you can also get to from our main ethicalmarkets.com. And basically, the very newest one I was just talking about with the diamonds made by human ingenuity, that one is Ethic Mark Gems, all one word, plural, .com.
Well, it's so nice talking to you.
Great talking to you again. And thank you so much. I've enjoyed this.
I've been speaking with Hazel Henderson, world-renowned futurist, evolutionary economist, and founder of Ethical Markets Media.
I'm Matt Stannard with the Public Banking Report, and I just have to say, the logic of finance capital continues to amaze me. What an Alice in Wonderland world we live in. The economy is sluggish, the ruling class periodically creates money out of thin air to save itself, and then wrings its hands when that doesn't make things better. Banks and firms take billions of dollars from municipalities in the form of interest rates and fees, and then we wonder why our cities explode with violence and rage. Then, when we don't spend the few cents we have quickly enough, the bankers want to punish us for not spending money. European central bankers have begun implementing negative interest rates on commercial bank reserves. Some officials at the Federal Reserve in the U.S. are calling for the same thing. The purpose of negative interest rates, the new policy the central banks charge consumer banks for keeping their deposits, seems to be to stimulate the economy. The theory seems to be that banks will lend out their money to businesses and other spenders more readily if they have a disincentive to hoarding the money. But the banks still don't have any real incentive to loan out money. If zero or near zero interest rates didn't get them there, then charging them a few cents on the dollar or less to keep their money in a central bank won't get them there either. Why? Because they'll just pass that cost on to individual depositors. That cost may come in the form of direct fees for deposits, or it may come in the form of charging for services, checking fees, debit card fees, higher overdraft fees, and the like. As Ellen Brown wrote this week, consumers today already have very little discretionary money. Imposing negative interest without first adding new money into the economy means that they will have even less money to spend. This would be more likely to prompt them to save their scarce funds than to go on a shopping spree. Hey bankers, you can't make ordinary people spend money they don't have or barely have or feel like they might not have tomorrow. It's funny how the ruling class alternates between lamenting the carelessness and lack of frugality of the working class and then cries when the working class actually behaves responsibly, saving money rather than spending it. And on top of that, more and more people the world over simply don't have the money to spend. More and more people lack surplus resources of any kind. The so-called sharing economy is really an economy where a once high-paying job with benefits has become an independent contractor position where you are expected, and in some cases required, to purchase those benefits with your own money. There is no liquidity in the working people's economy. And so, really, negative interest rates are a way of taxing the people's lack of money. And that doesn't make any damn sense. So what does make sense? Well, there are many possibilities, but I want to focus on one today. You can call it dividend income or basic income, but the idea is to give all citizens a basic level of financial security, an allowance, if you will. Calls for basic income date at least back to Thomas Paine, who in 1795 called for capital grants provided at the age of majority. One attractive facet of the idea is that it enjoys support from among thoughtful people across the entire ideological spectrum, including on the right, since libertarian-minded economists see it as an alternative to the bureaucracy of the welfare state. Some versions of the idea tie it into dividends produced by taxes on undesirable behavior like the burning of fossil fuels. Others see it as a way for society as a whole to profit from enterprises that utilize public commons as input resources or externalize costs back onto the commons or both. The means of implementation vary. Taxes are one way, but simple and honest injection of money into the economy, created the same way banks, including the Fed, create the money they lend, would work too. It wouldn't cause inflation, because inflation only occurs when the economy has reached full productive capacity, and everyone knows we're a long way from that. I like the idea of basic income for many reasons. But for our purposes today, since we've been talking about how rich people aren't moving their money and poor people have no money to move, I think the attractive facet of basic income is that it will create fluidity, energy, and activity where it is most needed. People will spend money on things and rebuild dying sectors of their communities. People will leave their jobs that they don't like and pursue the jobs that they do like. People will be healthier because it'll be easier to eat better and take care of themselves, which will make both the economy and civil society more vibrant. And people will refuse to accept bad things in their lives that drag down their creative and spiritual development. That's what we really mean by stimulus. It's what we mean by a robust economy and a robust society. People doing what they want, cooperatively and individually. And such activity does, in fact, make everyone's material lives better. In contrast, when I think of negative interest rates, I think of a cranky old farmer who, upon seeing that his mule can't or won't move faster, simply beats the mule with a stick. The mule's subsequent refusal to move only evidences to the farmer the necessity of beating the animal more. The thing is, fortunately, farmers are usually smarter and more sensitive than that. You don't harm a living being as an incentive to make it behave more productively. So why are central banks doing that? Why are actors affiliated with the Federal Reserve considering that? I don't know. Maybe they benefit from our insecurity and are reluctant to take that away. But if something isn't done about this on a central level, look for local communities to take it upon themselves to create money through alternative currencies and pump that directly into their own economies, legal or not, much like the town of Wargal, Australia did in 1932, or Paul DiFilippo's classic science fiction story Spondylix, where sandwich coupons become alternative currency that threatens to take over the entire East Coast. The choices before us are stark, but there's a clear difference between bold solutions that will help everyone and limited solutions that will help hardly anyone. The question is whose interests are accounted for. For It's Our Money, I'm Matt Stannard.
That does it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. If you'd like to stay current with Ellen's writing and commentary, visit ellenbrown.com. And if you'd like to know more about public banking and related developments around the country, please visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Visit them on Facebook and follow on Twitter at Public Banks Now. Our thanks to our guest today, and especially to our committed sponsors at Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services, dedicated to economic justice and fairness and the creation of new American public banks. Payment Management offers complimentary analysis of your current credit card needs and expenses at paymentmgmt.com. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. Thanks for listening, and see you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.